Saturday at my temple, we commemorated Shakyamuni Buddha's parinirvana. And part of that ceremony, I read the concluding portion of the Nirvana Sutra. In this case, the Theravadan version. And since then, I've been calling to mind again and again how Buddha's final words, he was surrounded by many disciples, and he'd been ill for some while, and was near death, and he says, disciples or you know, monastics, if there's anyone who has a question or a doubt about the teaching or the path, let them speak now. There's a long silence. And so Buddha asks again. And there's a long silence. And then a third time. And he concludes, in fact, he says he's able to see that there is no one in this crowd of disciples who has a question or a doubt about the teaching or the path. And then he says very, very famous words. He says, Anitya Bhata Sangskara Utpada Vyaya Dharminaha Utpadyahi Niruddhyante Tesham Vyupashana Sukham. Every component, every constructed thing is subject to falling away. Because having arisen, it ceases. Rendering this as peace is joy. So, does anyone have a doubt or a question about the path or the teaching? Yes?
I have a question about that teaching.
Sure.
You mean needing the truth that everything constructive falls away.
Mm-hmm.
Meeting the truth that everything constructed falls away. And just meeting that truth is joy.
Yeah, or peace. Yeah. Well, he's in that verse he speaks. He says the upashama, the complete pacification, tesham, of them, meaning all component things. That is peace. So he's saying in the midst of this ceaseless arising and passing away of everything that is component, compounded, which is like everything, to meet that as peace is the gateway to joy. So it's not like, oh yeah, well, you gotta, you know, make all that stop. It's like, yeah, I don't think so. And then, of course, there's that interesting passage where, those are the Buddha's last words. So evidently, somebody who was there could perceive that Buddha entered the 8 dhyanas, the 4 dhyanas of our realm, and then the formless dhyanas. And then he returns down through them all again, back to the first, and then up again to the 4th, and then he passes away. So how anybody knew that, I don't know, but that's what they say happened. And it was interesting, you know, those dhyana practices were supposedly things, you know, Buddha actually learned those from someone else, from his teachers he encountered who were celebrated for their meditative accomplishments in his day. So he didn't invent that stuff. And he used that stuff to the degree that it was helpful. But it's interesting that when he died, he went to all the way up through the trance of, they say, cessation, where basically everything kind of stops, and then back down all the way to the first dhyana, which is, as you may recall, characterized by what these terms mean. You can make of them what you will, but initial application of thought, and then sustained reflection, then joy, and then ease or peace, and then equanimity. So the first dhyana, so to speak, has all of these characteristics. And then as you ascend, and you get to the 4th, the other characteristics have fallen away and only leaves upeksha, or equanimity. And that was the, you might say, point of departure, equanimity. And even though presented there as kind of like a meditative accomplishment, there is ample equanimity here now with us. Something about, I've noticed, sitting with a group of people and sometimes giving a talk, I don't know what it is about that, but that equanimity feels very, very close. Not like something, I'm going to have to become this great yogi before I will experience equanimity. Well, no. You're actually experiencing it now. And it will help if, you know, we resist the temptation to kind of pick at it. It's like, well, is this equanimity equanimous enough? Or should I kind of crank it up somehow? That's the sort of fiddling that is really completely unnecessary. And it's remarkable how close, you could say, peace is to us all the time. And if, you know, maybe you think you don't feel peaceful enough. Anybody not feel peaceful enough? You can actually sort of let that go. what presents itself in the next breath is just this body mind right now. Now, maybe you were hoping for more than that. It's like, well, okay, and you know, who knows what's going to happen. Now, you might suddenly have massive insight into reality. And, well, if that happens, you might get kind of excited and then not be quite so equanimous. You know? Maybe you feel like getting up and hopping around and saying, I have discovered reality. This is enough. Or as you know, famous story, a couple of Zen worthies were out strolling in the mountains, and one says, you know this one, one says, just here is the summit of the mystic peak. And the other one looks, nods, and says, yes, such a pity. It's true. Such a pity. Quite a few years ago, a scholar and practitioner named Lucian Strike. I think some of you heard of him. He wrote a quite an interesting book called "Once Born, Twice Born Zen." Maybe you've seen that. I think it's long out of print. But he presents Zen from a couple of different viewpoints. One is that we are, you know, inherently we're really deluded, and we need to be reborn in an enlightened frame of mind before we can, inherit our own humanity. That's the twice-born Zen. And the other once-born Zen is we are completely without obstruction, we are the heirs of our own humanity right now. And we don't need to go hunting for something else. And these two visions or versions of Zen or practice are still represented. And you can run into people who are kind of in each camp. Yeah. And I was in the twice-born camp for quite a while. And then one day I kind of found myself in the once-born camp, and I wasn't sure how I got there. But that's kind of where I stayed. So I should be upfront about that. If some of y'all are in the twice-born camp, that's okay. But my experience of things is a little more the other way. What we are born with is something remarkable. And that to sit in the fullness of that without trying to construct some special vision of it, or curate your own experience so that only kind of cool stuff, Buddha stuff, happens, is actually kind of self-defeating. However, it's not that the twice-born thing has no currency, even in our own orientation to practice. But I guess I'd say that the sort of the gateway to being reborn, so to speak, is actually, you might say, illuminated by the precepts. So for us, rebirth is actually expressed through declaring our life to be lived on the basis of, well, for us, the 16 Bodhisattva precepts. This is a rebirth. A sort of a renewal of the basis from which we will live our life.
You mean taking the precepts?
Yeah.
In some way.
Well, the ceremony is like an acknowledgement.
Right.
Yeah. And there's sort of echoes here of even, you know, in Christianity, and Jesus talks about being reborn. And he too is, I think, talking about rediscovering the basis of our life and having that be inseparably involved with the well-being of others. I was listening to a podcast or something, I think, the other day, and Bob Thurman, one of my favorite commentators, was saying, I haven't heard this before, so maybe it's just his notion, but, you know, we have the expression, Bodhisattva Mahasattva. And he was saying, well, the Bodhisattva is definitely one who is dedicated to awakening. But the Mahasattva, so the Bodhisattva Mahasattva, the Mahasattva is one who is also dedicated to the awakening of others. So we have that, usually we have that expression, we say Bodhisattva Mahasattva, wisdom beyond wisdom.
I thought Bodhisattvas, by definition, were dedicated to the liberation of...
Yeah, but when they actually, you know, put that in gear, then they're a Mahasattva. We've all, you know, I think you all have taken that, have expressed the Bodhisattva vow, you know. And, the mysterious process of getting that in gear is a little bit, it's hard to grasp. But as that happens, you are all Mahasattvas, great beings, great heroes. He likes to use that expression, heroes and heroines. This wisdom beyond wisdom we talk about, you know, the Heart Sutra the Sanskrit Heart Sutra starts off let's see. Arya Avalokiteshvaro Bodhisattva gambhiram prajna paramita charyan charanano tangscha panchaskandhang svabhava shunyan pashyati sma. The great hero, the great wisdom hero, and the great champion of others hero, Avalokiteshvara, says Charamana was, one of the translations is coursing. But charati, the verb, can mean going, right? Or carrying on, carrying along. The gambhira, the deep prajna paramita charya, the activity of perfect wisdom. And now, mostly, or you know, a lot of the time, when we are charatiing along, it's like we're kind of doing some other stuff too. Let's put it that way. Oh, so I was going to start this talk with confession and repentance. This morning, it was getting kind of late, and I hadn't bought my train tickets, and I wasn't really packed. And I thought, well, I better get moving here, and I discovered that it seemed that I had torpedoed the whole computer network in my building. And single-handedly, I did this. And, you know, I have to confess, I got kind of upset. I was kind of pretty agitated there, gritting my teeth and cursing and kicking the furniture. And this was not helpful, you know. And this this kind of charati is not the helpful kind. So, you know, this can happen. You know, the energy of the samskara skandha, the skandha which has all of our feelings involved, can be very powerful. And let's admit it. And that sometimes the waves that come up will carry us along for a while until we can say, wait a minute here. This is getting a little out of hand. It would be good to stop and let things be for a moment. And in so doing, the coursing in the deep practice of perfect wisdom can happen. So I want to confess that I was not being very skillful this morning. Luckily, I discovered that I hadn't actually torpedoed the whole network, so that was a relief. But still, even if I had, you know, there are better ways to engage our practice than running around kicking the furniture and cussing. So I, too, had these moments where the tsunami of the samskara skandha is carrying me along for a while before I remember. It's like, oh, wait a sec. Hang on here. It's much easier when there are other people around, in a way, because they can remind us, what's going on over there? Hello? I was in my chamber all alone, kicking the furniture, so there wasn't anyone to say, well, what's the problem here? For a moment, it seemed like I had actually locked out all of our computers from the router. Oh, really smart. It was really clever. So when that happens, you know, maybe there will be someone else around who will look at you kind of funny. What is going on with that person? You go, oh, yes, right. Sorry. I should let the deep practice of perfect wisdom roll along here by just standing here and not doing anything. Just breathing my breath, letting my irritated little thoughts run along, and joyfully acknowledging that there's something else going on too. That the deep nature of things is undisturbed. And that undisturbed nature is something all of us have. Or are. Maybe not have, but are. And in so doing, it says, as you know, Avalokiteshvara saw that the five aggregates of being are, actually it uses the past tense for some reason, it says pashyati sma, which means saw, that they are svabhava shunyan. They're not only empty, they're empty of something specific, namely being from their own side. They have none of that. Nor does anything else. And that is profoundly true whether we're feeling agitated or not agitated or happy or sad or confused or perfectly clear. So it's good when something at need reminds us. It's like, you know what, just like as Dogen says, take the backward step, right? Which doesn't mean you go anywhere. Right? That's just that moment of, oh, wait a sec here. Nothing of what is happening now exists from its own side, including me. What a relief that is. So I first of all, I have to uncross my legs here. Oh. I think I have to thank you guys for such easy access to equanimity, as we are all granting each other now. You may wish, you know, that you could kind of gussy up your state of mind so it's more glorious looking. But I would say, you know, you don't need to do that. You're not practicing Zen so that you can glorify your state of mind. You're practicing Zen to appreciate the subtle glory of what is already. And that may inspire you to opt for rebirth as a great hero of the Bodhisattva precepts, for instance. And you can tell the universe that that's how you're going to be living. And then at some point, someone may say, well, let's have a ceremony. Where you make that declaration publicly. And then all your fellow beings can hold you to that, which is also very helpful. They'll say, remember when you said you were going to have the basis of your life be the 16 bodhisattva precepts? Remember you said that? And then it may be appropriate to feel sort of abashed, a little embarrassed, to say, well, yes, I did say that. And I'm going to start doing that right now again. So thank you very much for reminding me. And you start anew. Moment after moment, you start anew. Especially those pure precepts, those are great, aren't they? I will embrace and sustain upright conduct. I will embrace and sustain all good. And I will embrace and sustain all beings. Pretty much nails it down, you know. Aren't a lot of loopholes there. And then to kind of prop that up, you have the refuges to begin with. Take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And then you have the clear mind precepts, the 10 clear mind precepts, which enormously help us reduce the racket of confusion to a minimum. That's what those are for. Sometimes people equate them with the Ten Commandments, and I guess that works up to a point, but really they're for the sake of clarity. And clarity makes it much, much safer to be coursing among beings as a great hero. Even though, of course, you should not tell yourself that's what you are. That's for others. And don't be too discouraged if nobody calls you that. That's all right. You're doing that anyway. And clarity helps an awful lot avoiding, serious mistakes, which can happen. I've been blathering on for a while here, and maybe by this time, someone has now a doubt or a question about the path or the teaching.
Yes. There's small and great questions, and there's a great many doubts, and this mind accepts that. And to entertain one doubt and one question, how can the 16 precepts become one?
Well, I guess I don't know if they need to. They're okay as 16. But as one, they're, as I've been saying, they're kind of a rebirth. As one, there are rebirth, a renewal of the basis of our life. But they're also okay at 16, so either way. In actual life, it seems to me they can appear individually, and they can also kind of be there as just one luminous something or other. So either way, I think they work. Okay with that for now? Thank you for the courage to doubt. When I was a kid growing up, we were discouraged from doubting. And in fact, if Sister Mary so-and-so caught you doubting, you could suffer as a result. But that makes for a very brittle faith, where you don't dare doubt. That's not good. Doubt is okay. Doubt is part of our body-mind musculature or something. It's all right. To meet doubt with this whole body-mind over and over again, that's the way. That's the way it works. And shrink away from it. Ew, doubt. Ew. Yes.
So when you said that Bob Thurman made a differentiation between the Bodhisattva and the Mahasattva,
yeah.
I'm wondering, is it maybe the same differentiation as between aspirational bodhicitta and actual bodhicitta?
Well, I don't know. I'm not all that familiar with that distinction. Could you tell us a little bit about the difference, those two kinds of bodhicitta?
I think the metaphor is aspirational bodhicitta is, I really want to go on a trip.
Uh-huh.
And the actual is like, you go.
Ah, okay.
That was the classical metaphor.
Yeah, maybe with aspirational, maybe we're even allowing ourselves to be hampered by the thought that, well, one day I will be able to manifest bodhicitta, but not today.
Doubt.
Yeah. Maybe. Bodhi, means awakening. And citta has all kinds of different meanings. But a straightforward translation is the thought of awakening. Namely, there is such a thing as awakening. And I would very much like to arrive there for the sake of suffering beings. So maybe that's one expression of aspirational bodhicitta. Maybe when we're sitting zazen, maybe that's bodhicitta arriving. Maybe you're embodying it. When you stop to think about it, maybe it gets more aspirational. Maybe.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, mm-hmm.
Yes.
So you've also answered the question how does the 16 precepts become one?
By embodying it.
Yeah. Yeah, Dogen says something like, when we sit zazen, what precept is not kept? Right. Yeah, right. when sitting zazen, what precept is not kept? That's kind of once more zen, rolling along there.
It's not a riddle.
It's not a riddle. No, it's not a riddle.
I'm in this sort of book club and we're reading a book of like Theravada Buddhism about the Eightfold Path. And as I was reading the introduction, I was getting kind of like, it's making me uptight. There's all these steps you have to take. And then I thought, but wait a minute, we have the Heart Sutra and it says there's no path, there's no cessation. There's is that like a escape valve or?
No, that's really just carrying Buddha's teaching all the way. Right? For maybe quite a long time, it was helpful to people to have, you know, these various lists and concepts ready to hand. And then maybe at some point it became time for people to see, well, actually, if you look at Buddha's teaching and carry it all the way, that stuff also does not have svabhava, does not exist from its own side. In fact, the Eightfold Path is empty. Just like poor Emperor Wu, you know, asked Bodhidharma, you know, we get right down to it, Bodhidharma, what is the supreme meaning of the Four Noble Truths, which is like the essence of Buddha's insight? And what does Bodhidharma say? Somebody?
Emptiness,
nothing holy. Tanto's voice is very quiet. You know, so empty, no holy. And supposedly the emperor was not quite ready for that, so he was left scratching his head.
Yeah, thank you.
What the heck?
So I'm not really quite sure what I want to ask, but it's kind of about the Heart Sutra and about the interdependence of all things, how nothing is anything by itself.
By itself.
Is there some sort of practice that, or is it the realization of that, that we ultimately experience peace and the emptiness? Or is it, I mean, is there some sort of practice that we can do to really come to fully realize, I guess, to go from sort of the unaspiring to an actualized?
Yeah, that's called zazen.
That, but no, I mean
that,
more
that
specific.
That is that practice. No, it's, you know, you don't want to practice that's too specific, you know, that's too narrow. You want one that's kind of open to the whole universe, which demonstrates again and again the truth of emptiness.
Uh-huh. I see what you're saying. But sometimes I feel like when you're talking about peace, being peaceful and equanimous,
yes,
you know, that I feel like I may be drifting into sort of a passive, I wouldn't even want to call it that, but by society standards, I almost would. And so I'm uncertain about, you know, there being a more concentrated, pinpointed seeing, like the fact that I'm actually perceiving the light from, you know, I don't know. Thank you.
Zen, easy, easy. I wasn't trying to get you to shut up.
It actually worked. But, I mean, there was, yeah, but Zen was good.
Keep at it.
My question is, and I'm thinking this is doubt that I feel in my body. How do we actually know the Buddha was in the fourth jhana at the moment of parinirvana?
Well,
how does one know?
You got me. Supposedly, somebody was there who's the psychic powers were so developed that they could eavesdrop on what was going on with Buddha. That's the only explanation I've ever heard. Right? Otherwise, you know, that's just the story that's told. Right? But it is interesting that Buddha did not go all the way up to number 8 and then depart. No, he came all the way back down to number 1 and then back up to equanimity and then drifted away. I always found that very interesting.
He did not complain. What if he had not gone back to the fourth? What if he had passed away
from number 8?
In the first jhana.
In the first.
And he was Buddha.
I think that's how we'd tell the story. And that would be fine too.
So nothing holy about the fourth jhana.
No. No, Buddha was pretty clear. That stuff is just useful to the degree that it's useful. So don't get hung up on it.
Yeah, I guess you almost answered my question. I used to be very confused about that. It's like, are these like psychological states that we, you know, pass through in order and when we're meditating, and this is what I'm supposed to experience when I start meditating, and then when I sit for like an hour or 2 hours or 20 days or 110 days, I get another notch up, like I'm inching up the top. But do you think it really is a description of psychological states? Because there's such insight into the human mind in many of these, all of these teachings.
Yeah.
That it's, to me, as I'm listening to it, I used to see this as like something I had to achieve.
Right.
You know, I had to get to this one, and I never got the joy. I never did figure out how to get to there. but equanimity, I can feel pretty cool. You know,
I'm okay.
But is it really just a parable, a description to help the human minds understand processes?
This
that
is
happen?
One of many maps. One. Maps.
Oh, map.
One of many maps. And what do we know about maps? They are not the territory. So even though some people will say, oh yes, you can always tell when someone's in number 8, they look like this and, such and such. Well, for instance, someone who has achieved, it's not even 8, but beyond 8, there's another one. Where supposedly you're basically dead, right? The only difference is, I think you're not cold, and you still have a little color in your cheeks. Other than that, you might as well be dead, right? And this, you know, some people say, oh, yes, I knew so-and-so back there in Thailand, and he was definitely doing that. And, well, maybe, I don't know. One of the questions that I love to trot out, you know, is that, and as I say, people still argue about this. If there is such a trance, how do you get out of it? Because everything has stopped. How do you get out of it? And they argue back and forth, right? And they've been arguing for 2,000 years. No, more than that, probably. Oh, sorry. I'm supposed to take some medicine, but never mind. Frogs? Frogs can do it, apparently. So that's some little encouragement for us. If a frog can do it, maybe I can do it. But again, it's just a map, right? And sometimes if you're, you know, if you are with a lot of people who use that map a lot and find it helpful, then you might also. Right? On the other hand, if you're with a bunch of Zen people, they maybe find something else useful. And so you might kind of use their maps for a while. But none of those maps is the territory. None of them. Yeah.
Just a little aside. You're talking about that, I guess, the ninth stage or whatever?
Yeah.
I was reading this article about how in China, monks would try to get into that state, and then they'd get mummified. And occasionally they'll find these mummified monks, like Huineng, is that how you say it?
Huineng, yes.
Yeah, he's actually went into that state, and they mummified him. And then there was this Buddha statue, and they dropped it, and it cracked, and they found one of those monks inside.
There was a guy in there?
Oh. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's not like, and they would eat like pine needle dust, and then they'd...
Yeah, some people would drink lacquer, which can't be very good for you.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you go to... if you go to Koyasan in Japan, where you're going, you make sure to go to, there's this magnificent cemetery that's like, I don't know what, a kilometer or two long. It's just wonderful. And at the very end is Okuno-in, which is the temple where Kobodaishi is in eternal samadhi. And I swear to God, when you're there, it feels like it. It actually feels like it. It's like, this is what's happening. He's in there. Kobodaishi is the guy who brought Shingon Buddhism to Japan, right? Esoteric Buddhism. And he's supposedly in there, in eternal samadhi, in some state like that. So maybe that's possible. I don't know. I don't actually know anyone who's done that, I don't think. But I'm more comfortable thinking, well, that's another story about this wonderful, ungraspable life of ours. Yeah. Yeah, you got another mic there.
Thank you. Thank you. So I don't feel it exactly as a doubt. It's more sort of a failure to plunge in to the Dharma, to the precepts. And basically, it's a picking and choosing among things, and particularly people. So there's, it's associated a lack of equanimity there too.
What do you mean by picking and choosing among people? I mean, some of them are annoying, for instance.
I feel less close to some of them.
Yeah.
As my teacher once said, people are the problem.
Oh boy, that's true.
But the picking and choosing, I think, that are actually the problem, at least for me, subjectively.
Well, give yourself a little elbow room there, and you may be. For instance, today I was in the horrible Transbay temporary terminal there in San Francisco, and not feeling so hot. And some guy behind me leaned over and kind of hissed in my ear and said, "Hey man, how about a couple of bucks for food?" And I was kind of like annoying. It's like, I'm this poor clergyman. Why don't you ask someone else? I mean, I didn't say that. Actually, I did say, "I'm this poor clergyman." I didn't say, "Go ask someone else." I said, I don't want to do that. But I was, so that wasn't so great. I mean, I could have just opened my wallet and said, "Here," but I didn't feel like doing that. And but I also was ready if he wanted to continue our interaction. I was there. I'm like, okay. And that had to be good enough right then. And I don't know what would have happened if he'd said, "How about 50 cents, or something." And maybe I would have said, "Well, all right, 50 cents, or whatever."
So I want to be like that. I want to be ready to continue the conversation.
Oh, I think you are. I think you are.
Not always.
Well, next time, you know, give yourself a break and say, I think maybe I'm ready to continue the conversation. And maybe that other person won't be. And then you're off the hook.
No, because I want to have a conversation with her.
All right. Well, one day at a time, like I say. Charlie, maybe we will go to bed soon, because it's kind of... Yes?
Thanks. I'm not quite sure how to articulate this either, but I became really interested in how what arises falls away is all part of one movement or something. And so if you think of rising up of a thought and the falling away of a thought, then maybe it's really not about the thought. It's about some kind of energy movement. I don't know. And that sort of gets underneath the content construction of something.
Mm. Yeah.
Does that make any sense?
Yeah, kind of. It's like someone was talking to me recently, and also I was just reading recently. You know, they're arguing about you know, consciousness. What is consciousness? And some pretty serious science types are saying, well, we think, some of us think, that there is some kind of potential field that is omnipresent throughout the universe, and consciousness is drawing from that somehow. So that means there's some kind of field throughout everything, everywhere, all the time. And one manifestation is body, minds, of beings, and the activities related thereto. So maybe that's kind of, maybe that's how it is. Of course, that's just another map, but maybe it's a kind of useful map for us nowadays.
Thank you.
Glimpsing the wisdom that runs through all things. Right. Huh?
So you think.
So you think. Okay, well, it's very nice visiting with you all. Look after each other and yourselves. We will meet again someday.